Hi, my name is Mahmoud Saleh. I'm a member of the Windows C++ team. We've met before. First time we've met, we discussed some of the CRT, what is a CRT and what does it do. And the second time, we've talked about some of the CRT advanced topics. I've got some questions from you, and some people asked for specific items to discuss about the CRT. And today we're discussing a new set of topics covering some of your questions as well as newer things, all of course within the CRT library. So let's start talking about CRT. Okay. So the first thing I'd like to talk about today is file.io. Some of you have been asking the question, why do we have two sets of CRT functions that deal with file.io? One set use open, write, and read. The other set is fopen, also f functions, fopen, fwrite, fread. And what are the difference between both of these? What does each do? So to put it simply, the first set is, which I would just refer to as raw I/O functions, such as open, read, and write, is a direct mapping between the CRT functions and the OS or Win32 API functions. For example, Win32 API call create file either creates a new file or opens an existing file. So we map this directly to open and create in the CRT raw I/O. Similarly, we have read file and write file, which we map to our read and write I/O functions. There is nothing actually more than translating a few of the input parameters into what the Win32 API is expecting, but there isn't much more. We don't do any buffering. We don't do any additional modes. It's just one-to-one mapping. What about the fopen and fwrite functions? Okay, these are a little bit different. Here we do a little bit more processing. So first thing we do is buffering. So I refer to that after that either as stream I/O or buffered I/O functions. So when fopen opens a file, it opens the mode specified by the user, but then the first time it reads or writes, it creates a buffer. And it uses then that buffer for buffering data that's being read from the file or written to the file. Of course, there's also some other layers of buffering. For example, the OS will do some buffering to make sure the file is fast. But if you want another additional layer of buffering, which should improve speeds in some of the instances or some of the scenarios that you're using file I/O in, then it makes sense to actually go through the buffered I/O functions. There are a few other differences. For example, the way it complies with standards. Most people, if you would like to have your application as portable as possible, you may select one of both functions. It really depends on what level of portability you're looking for and what standards are you following. For example, the fopen is in the C99 standard, while the open is in the POSIX, so you will need to find out which one fits your needs more. So we talked about buffering, but when do we want to use a buffer really? And why would it really be useful in all scenarios? Okay, let's first of all, let's look at how we can control that buffer for stream functions, stream I/O functions. So one of the functions we have in the CRT is set vbuff. These functions allow us to specify a buffer or ask the CRT not to use any buffer at all. But when would we like not to use a buffer at all? It's in some scenarios. For example, you are reading a section, then jumping to another section within the file, or going to a specific, you're seeking LSeq or FSeq to a specific position in the file, then you're going to another. Then the buffer wouldn't be very useful. In fact, it may delay or may make your application slower, because if you're reading 8K or 4K instead of a couple of bytes and moving to somewhere else will further parts in the file that is not within the buffer range, then it doesn't really make sense to have a buffer. So it might be useful to turn that buffer off. Again, but when would you like to modify the buffer size? So by default in the CRT, the buffer size is 4K. Then Would it be useful? Yeah, in many instances it would be useful. But for example, if you're reading large amounts of data, let's say you're going through a couple of megs of data within one file, then you don't really want to read 4K by 4K. It makes sense to read 32K or 64K or whatever your application is really capable of doing, and depending on your needs and, of course, architecture and hardware you're dealing with. So let's look at one sample of using set VBuf here. So here's one sample. You can specify your own buffer. Let's turn this sample on. So this sample is using fopen. As we've already discussed, it's really much better to use the secure functions rather than the non-secure functions. So here I'm using fopen underscore s instead of fopen. In other samples, I may forget and use one of the other functions, but it's always better to use secure functions. This one, for example, the difference between fopen underscore s and the fopen is this one will return an error number that will tell you what happened exactly if something went wrong, if you were unable to read the file, for example. So this sample is quite straightforward. It reads two files. For one of them, it sets the buffer size to the same, to actually the buffer we have created. And it allows you to use this the buffer here as your buffer. The other sample turns off buffering altogether, so it will actually say use the option here no BF or IO no buffer, while this one uses file FBF or file buffer. These are the two modes that we can apply to buffers. There's one third mode that's used for lines. We don't support this in Win32 API, so we still accept it as one of the inputs for the CRT, but it will function exactly as if it is a file buffer. Whatever size you specify here is whatever you get for buffering. So the sample is quite simple. Open two files, set one of them. And if this one succeeds, set VBuf the first one, we write stream one now has a buffer of size and stream. So let's execute this sample. So we step through the file, here we create the buffers, we open both of them, okay, good, we have the files here, so the files are really, I've already created them, file1.txt and file2.txt, so they are already within my application. Then I'm reading something from the file. Actually, look at the file, so my file has some Microsoft data, so I've read that. I've read only 100. So the reason I've read it, so set up the buff. Then I'm actually setting the buff here. So succeeded. So set VBuf return 0, which means it succeeded. 0 means succeeded. Non-zero value, it means it failed. And if it fails, you should try to find the error number, errno, to find out what happened. It will indicate what the failure, okay. And now the file buff is 1024. Here I'm, for stream number 2, I'm setting the file buff to 0, so it's going to print, no buffer, as expected. And at the end, you have to remember to close all the files. So fclose all is really close all files, as it indicates. Okay. And if you look at the output here, stream 1 has a buffer of 1024 and has no buffer. Okay. So as we always do, we try to get a little bit more, dig a little bit more into the CRT functions and find out what's happening. So I'll go through two of these functions and find out what's happening here. So first, fread. So what happens when you try to read data from a file? And specifically, what happens to the buffer when we try to read this data? So here, So I'll step into Ifrit. So basically, as you've seen, actually I'm not using Ifrit underscore s, but internally the CRT is. So it's a good thing that we're doing this. And stepping quickly through it. For security, we'll try to do some memset. And I'll go. So once I've received a question about how is a CRT made, I think, allow multi-threaded programming. So the way we do this is via locks. Before doing any of our reads or writes or effects, before doing some manipulation of an object, we have to lock it to make sure that it's synchronized. So here, for example, we're reading from a file, so we're actually locking from the file. And then finally, we unlock it. And internally, we call a no-lock function. Some of our no-lock functions are exposed directly. If you want to use these, then you can, but do this at your own risk, because it's, of course, not recommended unless you know how to, unless you want to do the synchronization yourself. So that's how we really synchronize the CRT functions. Lock, do something unlocked, then unlock. That's like the pattern we use throughout the CRT. Of course, some of them don't require synchronization, others are different. So anyway, so here, now internally, see what we do. So the fread will go, and you'll find out that it does a few similar things. Then I'll just skip slowly through the buffer. And I'm trying to find out how it actually reads. So the way we read really is we call one of the row-level I/O functions here. So actually fread, in fact, goes, or fread no lock, in fact, actually read through one of the low-level I/O functions. So we actually, so as you've seen, read is a lot faster than fread, because fread will actually do a lot of processing, copy data to use a buffer, and then read in that buffer. And finally call the low-level I/O function. So as you can imagine, this read is a lot faster, of course, if buffer was not accounted for. But since buffering is here, the next read is going to be a lot faster than the first. One more thing I wanted to show you is the buffer size. So here we check if we already have a buff, and if we do, we use this buffer. Otherwise, we use the internal buff size. By default, the internal buff size, unless you determine a buffer already, by default, the internal buff size is 4K, 4096. So that's the buffer we do. Now, I'll go all the way to read. Actually, I think there's one more read here. Oh, I think actually this one is. Oh, I'll debug that later. So I will don't want to waste your time and go into code that. So the other function I really want to show you is how we set the buffer. So here, set buffer, as the documentation tells you, it controls a buffer at size. It has three inputs: IONBF, no buffer, IOFBF, or IOLBF, which is the same as IOFBF, which is line buff. We don't really have special treatment for IOLBF here. I'm going to just go quickly through the code. So basically, if it's not one of the types, we actually validate. We do this throughout the CRT. You validate the input, making sure that you specify the valid input. And then one other thing we do actually is a buffer size in order to optimize the performance is divisible by 2. It has to make sure that it is a multiple of 2. So what we do here is we mask down, and this ensures that we actually the buffer size is a multiplication of 2. For example, if you specify 97, it will be something else divisible by 2. Okay, and we're done here. Okay, so that's for buffering. Okay, so as I said, there are some scenarios where buffering is cool, it's going to be nice to use it. Other scenarios, it's not so advisable. However, I would think that in 90% of the scenarios, buffering is better to use than non-buffered I/O, unless you have a specific reason to, unless you're skipping through the file. But if you're reading sequentially, then certainly read all the files through a buffer. And depending on the data size you're reading, you may also want to update the buffer size and use a different buffer. Of course, a few things to caution you here. So here, for example, I'm using a buffer that's declared internally within the function. You would not want to do this. What you want is declare a buffer that's global, or not so desirable probably, but make sure that your buffer is dynamically allocated. And because by the end of this function, the buffer will be gone. So this one is okay to use here. But if you're reading or writing in different functions, of course, you need to create a buffer that's available to all functions, not just throughout this specific function. Okay, let's move on to a different topic. So we've talked several times about JS handling and exceptions. Well, the reason I'm really tying these to each other is because they are in a way related. I mean, so both of them raise some exception, but we treat them a little bit differently in the C runtime. So the first one I'd like to talk about is JS handling. What's JS handling? What do we do here? To put it simply, what we do is the compiler makes sure, or actually the C runtime and the compiler together make sure that we don't overstep the buffers we have created. So if we have, for example, allocated some data on the stack, similar to the example we've just seen, which is a car of 1024, then you overwrite, then you write at position 1025 or 2000 or something, then what will happen, you will be able to, you will actually, that will result in writing on some sensitive data. For example, the return address. If you override the return address, a hacker can use this same way of overwriting return address and go to any other address or address to a function called hack, for example, or something else. So we in the CRTU, we try to limit that as much as possible. And the way we do it, there are multiple ways. One of them is we use what we call a JS cookie. So a JS cookie is a data, some form of a double word or something, that is put at a certain address, and every time we write, we check if that cookie or that specific piece of data has been overwritten or not. If it's been overwritten, we know that something bad has happened. And if it's been overwritten, we have two mechanisms to actually tell the user that something bad has happened. Or even if this is not running on debug, even if it's running with the release, we make sure that the application cannot continue. It is terminated, because writing to beyond the buffer size may just ensure that someone else can come and write to the same buffer beyond the buffer size and decide what to do with your application. And of course, you don't want to do this. So we use two things. First of all, we use the JS cookie handler. We first check the stack pointer and the cookie and make sure that we are everything is okay. But if it's not okay, we call this cookie handler. Also, if you're building with RTC runtime checks, the compiler and the CRT together will find out if something bad has happened. RTC is not really recommended for retail because it's a lot slower than non-RTC, so you may want to make use of it only during development phase. So here, let's look at some examples. Actually, the example here is quite simple. So what I do here is that I have a buffer of size 10, a char buffer. However, instead of writing 10 characters to that buffer, I'm actually writing 100. So what will happen here? Let's see if we run this application. Okay. Let's run it without really having any other breakpoints. So actually, there's one here. Let's keep it here. Okay. First, a runtime check was triggered. The runtime check found that something we have written outside the buffer limits. Okay, so the data around it was corrupted. This is on the stack, so it was because, of course, buff was available on the stack. So because we declared it as a local argument, so it was declared on the stack instead on a heap. So it's here. So we have the option either to continue, ignore that, or break. If you ignore it, then number line 2, the defense line number 2 is triggered, which is the GS handler. So here it tells us, okay, something is triggered. Here's the GS code, GS reporting code, and tells us, oh, something has happened because you have overwritten the buffer, and this is the issue. What do you want to do? You want to break or continue? If you continue, okay, the application actually will not allow us to continue. It will just crash, and I will show you each of these step by step. Okay, so let's run this again and analyze each of these. So I'll put a breakpoint right after the buffer has been written to, and let's see what happens. So here, until now, nothing has happened. The statement just continued. Of course, you can see here the stack corruption. It's not, the buffer overrun is not detected yet. This call stack has been corrupted. That's why you can see some unnecessary data. But we haven't reached the end of the function yet, so we didn't detect that there is a buffer overrun. So let's look at the disassembly of this. So here is what we do. So we're almost returning, but before returning, because we have enabled RTC checks, so the compiler have inserted the RTC call here. And this is the first RTC call. It says RTC check stack variables. What will it do? As the name implies, it will really check stack variables. If we don't compile with RTC, this code will not be here. Okay, so let's call the RTC. So basically, but before doing this, I'll put a breakpoint right after, just before the second call here, this call to security check cookie here. And I will continue. Oh, so now check stack var here. What it did, it actually just popped up a message. It actually found this some problem with stack variables, and it popped up a message here. So I can either break or continue. I'll continue, I'll ignore that. And this is the second line of defense, which is our security cookie. This is not really the handler. This is just a check that's always put. By default, security cookie checks are on. And the way to put it is use a GS slash or forward slash GS when you compile your application. And if you want to disable it, don't really see so many reasons to disable it. But if you want to disable it, you justify forward slash GS minus. And let's also step over this. And here's what it does. It's just triggered this. And here, this code is, and I will break here. This code is inside report failure handler here. And what it does, it really, as the name, the comments here imply. Oh, sorry, we are not in, let's go to source code mode. And actually, this is used to report a security check failure, okay? And let's step quickly through it. So finally, because execution was not allowed, we have a debugger hook that was executed, and we go through this. Okay, and if we continue, the application will just crashes. That's because terminate process here was called. Okay, and it actually was crashed because these two calls, set unhandled filter exception to null, which we delete any unhandled filter exception, and we call the unhandled filter exception for the OS, which by default calls Watson or WER, Windows Error Reporting. Okay, what if we disable RTC checks? Let's see. So default is nothing, and if we go through here, okay, no RTC checks. You just break here and continue. I would like to show you the code without RTC checks. What does it look like? Let's stop here and let's compile again. Step through the code. Go here and let's look at the, go to disassembly. As you can imagine, no RTC checks. The code is much smaller here. So just make sure, don't use RTC checks for your retail. By default, if you build as retail, RTC checks are not going to be disabled. However, you don't want to, the code for really security check is quite small, actually. If you go through it, if you look at the assembly here, checks the security cookie, it just compares, it's quite small. We've implemented so that it's quite small. What it does, it checks the input, the cookie, with what's available on the stack, which is at this point saved in ECX, security cookie, let's look at the hex value. So the input cookie was 0, and the security cookie is supposed to be this magic number. The security cookie is not a fixed number. It changes every time you run your application. And it is generated based on some randomness that's quite secure. So cryptography is secure. So, and then it checked that security cookie is not equal. So it will jump, or actually call, jump to report GS failure, which is a function we are in, which reports that something went wrong. This function will ultimately just terminate, as you have seen before. Okay. Okay. I will go back and turn on. So the default really is both for debug. In debug mode, we have both runtime checks on. One, okay, so one of them is for initialize, one of them is for stack from basically stack buffer overruns. Okay, by the way, I didn't really cause this. I think I've disabled this. So that's the default for C++ exceptions. Ignore this for now. Okay. So that was for buffer, for GS stack handling. Okay. I will. Now we're done with this example, so I'll turn it off. And let's turn to another topic. So we've discussed how the GS cookie handler works and how is it triggered, what are RTC, and these are all ways to safeguard your application, and it's really important to understand the concept here. Now, a similar, actually a related topic is how exceptions work in C++, and what is the role of the CRT here, what does it do, and of course, I'm here to talk about C++ exceptions only. SEH exceptions, a try except, that could be another discussion if you want to, of course. Try catch finally is a C++ way of handling exceptions. It's a lot more portable than SE exceptions, so this is what you should use in any modern application. So how does it work? It's really a shared effort, concerted effort from the compiler, the C runtime, and of course the user code, which orchestrates all of this. So the user code, you tell your application, throw something, catch something. So this is your code that tells the CRT and the compiler what to do. The compiler then generates some code and calls into CRT functions. Whenever you throw, you are telling really the CRT to do something, the compiler to do something. So the compiler generates code to call the CRT. Internally, the C++ exceptions uses the same exception mechanism that any other component within Windows does. It really call a function. If when you throw, you call a function that raise exception, which is raise exception, and sometimes you may find RTL raise exception, which is really almost does the same thing. And internally we use it, but for C++ we have added a little bit more logic. So we have used some magic numbers. So when an exception is raised by an application inside a program compiled with the compiler, the Windows compilers that use these specific exceptions, it checks if the exception code and a specific magic number for this exception is what it would be expected for a C++ exception. And if so, it goes through the whole catch thing or finally thing. It actually treats it as in a different way than regular exceptions, and it doesn't go back to Windows. So let's look at some examples here. Again, this is a very simple example. Basically, it throws some exception and catch any exception. By itself, okay. Basically throw an exception, then catch it. Okay. Let's not load the simples, we don't need them right now. So before going through the throw, here we're gonna throw, let's look at the code here. So let's look at the disassembly. So really what throw does here is call C++ throw exception. This function is documented in the C in MSDN. So here this is a CRT call, and what it does, as you would expect, it would raise exception. So let's look at the code here. Okay. So you would expect this function to raise an exception, and indeed it should. So let's put a breakpoint at raise exception. Actually, I need to practice. Yeah, I don't have the simples here, so I will just not do. So basically this one will throw a C++ exception here, will throw an exception, and because I don't have a breakpoint anywhere else, so it stopped right inside the catch clause here. So print something, print an exception has been caught, and caught. But what happens, so we know what happens when we throw an exception. We call C++ throw exception, which in turn calls Windows function throw raise exception. But what happens when I want to, when we catch? Well, not really much different. We also, the compiler injects some code that will allow us to call some CRT functions. So the function that will catch this exception is called catch it. So let's run this again and find how the exception is being caught. I'll put a breakpoint here. Because whenever we throw, we really want to catch. So new breakout function, and this function is catch it. And here, so catch it is what catch semantics here does. It calls a CRT function catch it, and okay, we don't have source code. Source code for catch it is not available in the current version of the CRT. Maybe it will be available in a future version. And let's look at what catch it does here. So let's look at the locals, because it's quite interesting. So what it catches, as you can see, is really EH exception record. EH exception record is our known exception record. If you know about SEH and or Windows exception exceptions, then you know what EH exception record. Or to put it simply, an exception record is a set of information about an exception that's being thrown and or caught by an exception handling function. In this case, the CRT had an exception handler, or the compiler actually inserted an exception handling function and passed it to a CRT function, which caught this exception and finally passed it to catch it. So here's the call stack, find handler, so frame handler. The Windows passed it to the CRT, which finally found a handler and called catch it. Okay, and here's the exception record. This is the C++ exception code. Some flags, some information. We always pass for C++ native exception. We always pass three parameters, and exception records always has parameters that describe what to do with this information. There's also the exception address. This is the exception address. If you actually put it in the disassembly code here, it will just the return address of the function before it. So let's go back to the function, and here. Okay, the exception also information provides some, the exception parameter provide information at what type of exception is being caught. All of these details are in the throw info here, which is the third parameter of the exception record. And depending on this type, the code and the compiler and the CRT together to find out how to, what to do with that exception information. For example, if we have a native a pointer to an exception, it's a little bit different than if we throw an int or a float, for example. So the treatment here will be different based on how what's inside pthrow info. And then just go through the catch it, and finally the catch it code will also call your call catch block. So call catch block is really your application, what your application will do. So what's inside your catch clause here. So let's run all the way through catch block. So here there is nothing really in the window. As you would expect, the call catch block will actually just print the exception information through printf. So call catch block finally. Of course, there's a lot more code inside call catch block that prepares the function to call your handler or the code inside your handler. But this is what call catch block is finally role is. So, and as you expect, you are done here. So try catch and printf. Okay. So this was some of our demos. I have a few more topics to talk about. So a couple of topics, really. So one of them, I've received a question: what is the relationship between CRT and the Windows APIs? How does it treat the Windows API? How does it call this Windows API? Of course, the CRT, I'm always talking here about the Windows or the Microsoft C++ CRT. So as you would expect, because this is really Microsoft CRT, I would be calling into Windows API. So what we're doing here is CRT in many ways is either a thin or thick wrapper on top of Windows API. As you have seen in Open and FOpen, FOpen is a thick is a wrapper on top of Open, which is a wrapper on top of Create File. Similarly, Read and Write are wrappers on top of Read File, Windows 32 API Read File, and Windows 32 API Write File. So really what the CRT is doing is wrapping all of this function in a nice way so it can be portable, not only within your in multiple applications, but also portable across platform. For example, you can use, if you want your application to be portable enough, you can use CRT-only code. Don't call any Win32 APIs unless you need to, or within specific if depths of your application, and then you can easily after that port to any other architecture or environment. Also, not only we rely on OS for APIs, but we rely on concepts on OS. For example, as you've seen, exception handling is actually using the exception handling mechanism for Windows, the exception record and other the way that Windows raise exception or handle exceptions. So this is another way. We rely on the concepts in Windows as well as the API for Windows. So in many ways, CRT and Windows API are quite integrated. So I've also seen a question about, what about msvcrt.dll? So why are applications discouraged? Or actually, you're not totally allowed. You can link to any existing DLL if you want to, but it's very discouraged, really. You shouldn't be doing this at all. So msvcrt.dll is the Windows DLL for or Windows CRT DLL. It ships with every single version of Windows has its own msvcrt.dll. Your application should not link to it because we don't guarantee anything about msvcrt.dll, whether it will ship, it will actually application link to it will run down level, anything available in msvcrt.dll will be available in previous versions or even versions after this. So it's not really recommended, right? So what you should do is you should link to the MSVCRT that ships with Visual C++. And this is what any application should do. The current version of MSVCR is MSVCR100.dll. And or if you want to link statically, it's libcmt. It should be libcmt.lib, really. Each version of Visual C++ CRT comes tested and guaranteed to work with a certain number of OS versions. For example, the current version, Visual C++ 10, is built to run on XP, SP2, or later up to Windows 7. It's guaranteed to run. It's been tested, guaranteed. It should run without any issues, of course, other than the regular small bugs that we have, not rare bugs. Windows issue. So your application should not link to Windows CRT at all, MSVCRT.dll. Of course, it's actually hard to link to it because there is no lib for it, so it's not easy. The headers for it are not available. So some device drivers can link to it, but only a very few, and for specific needs that there is no time actually to talk about them. So. That's about Windows CRT and relationship to Windows APIs. So the final topic I'd like to talk about is the floating point support. So I don't have examples for this because you will find great examples on MSDN, but because the reason I've chosen not to have examples is because the topic is quite broad. It's quite large. There are lots of things to discuss here, but I'd like to talk about a few points. So what is the CRT floating point support? So we have a library in the CRT that has lots of floating point functions, tran functions, such as sine, cosine, absolute, lots of cosine, hyperbolic functions, even the the simple functions such as power or exp, for example. All of these are available through the CRT. A CRT implementation is architectural specific. If you're compiling for x86, then the implementation will be different than when you're compiling for AMD64 or another platform that the CRT may support. So the implementation is specific to the architecture. Normally for x86, it will use a mass coprocessor, or if you're building for SSE2 or for AMD, it will use SSE or SSE2, which are available in most modern processors. So, but in the current version, in newer versions of the CRT, actually that may change. So you shouldn't really. Some of the things you may want to do is make sure what architecture you're running on, what is the default architecture you're building for, and if you want to make decisions that are specific to floating points, you have to understand the implications of the architecture you're running on. I mean, for example, if you're running on SSE2, then you're not gonna touch the mass coprocessor or the floating point control registers. So it will be so your application should understand these decisions. You can also actually specify the architecture your application is running on. Users ARCH flag. Sorry, it's not in my notes here, but it's one of the flags that you can supply to your implementation. For example, if you know SSE2 is available, so on an x86, so you can actually build your application to use SSE2 using the ARC flag. There are also other flags for the compiler that works together with the CRT to tell the CRT what functions to call, of course, and tell the compiler how to handle specific floating point operations such as multiplication, division, and such things. So we have the FP flag, which tells it how do you want to treat the floating point operation. Precise is a default, and it's the most precise available. Except if you want to handle exceptions, then you have by default it's off. So this is really off. If you specify except minus, this is not going to change anything. There's also fast for the fastest possible, strict for another set of floating point options, and some of this can be combined together. Okay, or if you and you're also allowed to use the pragmas to set the theme. So, for example, pragma, float control, precise, on or off, we switch it on or off. So this is another way to, instead of having to compile with a specific option, you can use this inside your application. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because it actually also affects the behavior of your floating point. So, and it will affect the exception handling if you want to implement exception handling. For example, if you have overflow or underflow or divide by zero for floating points. By the way, divide by zero for floating points is different than divide by zero for integers. They are handled differently in the CRT. For floating points, this is a function of the floating point and the mass coprocessor or the SSE layer. But division by zero is handled by another layer, and division by zero would normally for integers would actually result in a different exception. So anyway, just wanted to mention that point. Internally, we handle floating point exception. If you enable floating point exceptions, and if you use control FP is one function that will allow you to control what exceptions to be turned on when exception is set. If you want that exception on or off, then you have to use a control FP function. And by default, the C++ the exception are thrown as SEH exception. Sorry, another error here. This is not SHE, it's SEH exception. So that's the default. And one function we use in the CRT to handle those floating point exceptions is set SE translator. So this one will get SE exceptions, and inside that function, you can actually throw other C++ exceptions if you want to. There are a few examples in MSDN. One of them is optimizing CRT floating point. If you look up optimizing CRT floating point, then you will find a very nice article in MSDN that actually talks about a lot of these topics. So to cap what we just talked about here is CRT floating point support is quite large. We have a large library of CRT functions that is optimized for every single architecture that the CRT supports. In Dev 10 or in Visual Studio 10, these were x86, x64, and IA64 architectures, and the library optimized. Of course, as you may know, that there are other support for RISC processors that are coming in the upcoming version of the CRT. The floating point support of the CRT will support these new processors as well. It will be optimized for them as well. That's really what I wanted to cover today. So thank you for your time, and as always, if you have any questions, please send them to me or send them through the page where this Channel 9 topic is Channel 9 video is presented, and I will try to answer them either in the same page or maybe through another video if you want to. Okay, thank you, and thank you for your time.